This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, April 4th, 2002. I'm Deepa Fernandez at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. The Israeli military offensive continues as more Palestinian towns are taken over by tanks and soldiers, and President Bush asks Israel to pull out of the towns they are occupying. Lawyers for Leonard Peltier bring a lawsuit against the former FBI director Louis Freeh, and the AFL-CIO calls for Congress to protect the pensions of workers across the United States to ensure what happened to Enron's workers never happens again. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Kata Mester with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Israeli soldiers continue their siege of Bethlehem's Church of the Nativity. Israel says Palestinian gunmen are holed up inside, but this pharmacist named Aziz, speaking from inside the church, says that's a misrepresentation.
We are here from about 4 days, and we are about 243 civilian persons, and some of them from the Palestinian police, and there is children with us. We are here without any treatment, without any food, without any medicine, without any drugs.
Aziz speaking to KPFA's Flashpoints from inside the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. This morning, President Bush announced he is sending Colin Powell to the Middle East. Sputnik Kilambi has the EU's response.
The U.S. decision to send Colin Powell to mediate between the Israelis and Palestinians has upstaged European Union efforts to seek a way out of the current crisis. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon refused to allow a delegation headed by EU Policy Chief Javier Solana and the Spanish Foreign Minister to meet the besieged Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. That delegation was originally due to have been headed by Spanish Prime Minister José María Aznar, whose country currently holds the EU presidency. Palestinian leaders have already said they would not meet any EU members if they were not allowed to visit Arafat. Aznar said that isolating Arafat was a mistake, adding that a breakthrough could only happen if the United States took a firmer stance. Sputnik Kilambi in Paris for Free Speech Radio News.
Today, Angola's army and the UNITA rebels signed a formal ceasefire, ending nearly 30 years of civil war. Rupert Cook reports.
The Angolan army and UNITA rebels have signed a peace agreement after 26 years of civil war in the oil and diamond-rich southern African nation. The peace agreement follows the killing of UNITA rebel leader Jonas Savimbi by government forces 6 weeks ago. Following Savimbi's death, talks between the Angolan military and the demoralized rebel movement began in earnest. Savimbi's death marked the culmination of an extended government military offensive against the UNITA forces, which had effectively destroyed the rebel movement's military capabilities. Although the UNITA rebels were Cold War allies of the U.S. government during the 1980s, the last decade has seen them ostracized by the international community. Previous peace talks have foundered in the past and led to renewed fighting. It remains to be seen whether the peace agreement between the government and UNITA rebels will lead to any meaningful improvement in quality of life for the majority of Angolans. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rupert Cook.
An environmental group accuses the White House of doing the bidding of ExxonMobil. Gareth Schweitzer reports from D.C.
ExxonMobil asked the White House's Council on Environmental Quality to replace Robert Watson as the head of the International Panel of Climate Change. The State Department said on Wednesday that it would support the Indian government's nominee for the position instead of Dr. Watson, who is a leading global warming expert. John Koifman of the Natural Resources Defense Council says that Exxon has spent large quantities of time and money trying to disprove the science behind global warming.
Exxon has a long track record of undermining in both the scientific process and more importantly, in the media and political arena, challenging the science behind conclusions that we've drawn on global warming and, you know, essentially in an effort to bottle up solutions and progress on solving the problem.
The Natural Resources Defense Council uncovered the memo through the Freedom of Information Act. Dr. Watson, who has led the panel since 1996, has warned repeatedly of the link between fossil fuel emissions and rising global temperatures. In Washington, D.C., for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gareth Schweitzer.
And finally, in Cincinnati, officials proposed a plan to halt police violence and to create an independent agency which would investigate allegations of police brutality. The agreement is in response to a suit filed by the ACLU, charging the Cincinnati police force with using excessive force against African Americans over the past 30 years. Andrea Carter is in Cincinnati.
this sort of changes how the police is going to take a look at the African-American community and how they use the use of the gun, chemical spray, beanbag shooting, just all kinds of changing policies. What the racial profiling lawsuit litigants did is that the city agreed to several Department of Justice recommendations, and they incorporated what the Department of Justice recommended into the collaborative agreement so that they're binding both through the Department of Justice and through the federal court, and they agreed with that.
Andrea Carter in Cincinnati. The tentative agreement does not end activists' call for entertainers and convention groups to cease boycotting the city. I'm Kutza Mester for Free Speech Radio News.
The situation in the Middle East worsened overnight as the town of Nablus was also taken over by the Israeli military. In Bethlehem, Israeli troops blew open a metal door leading into the Nativity Church courtyard and fired inside, wounding three people. The army denied soldiers made a move on the church, one of Christianity's holiest shrines, but said troops were chasing gunmen in the area. The Israeli military prevented reporters from reaching the church to assess the rival claims. All six West Bank towns taken over by Israel in the past week have been declared closed military areas, and reporters have been ordered to leave. Earlier today, Sharon agreed to permit U.S. Envoy Anthony Zinni to meet with Arafat following a meeting between Zinni and the Israeli Prime Minister. We go now to Mahar Spitani, who is an Arab-American living in Palestine and currently very close to the compound where Yasser Arafat is being held. Mahar, welcome to Free Speech Radio News. Could you give us the latest situation where you are right now?
Well, as you said, I'm 100 feet away from the compound, directly facing the hole that we see on television in the compound. As soon as President Bush gave his speech, actually before he finished his speech, a helicopter flew in and dropped off General Zinni. So General Zinni is right now in the compound talking with Yasser Arafat. The situation here is extremely bad. No electricity, no water. No one is allowed to move. They gave us yesterday 2 to 3 hours of curfew. Lifting the curfew. So, and they told us we can come out. Most of us didn't. There's tanks, like outside my house, there's two tanks parked right now, ripping their engines and hot dogging. I don't know what to tell you. Last night, it was terrible. Bethlehem was absolutely devastated. They went in into the Nativity Church. They killed Abuna Ayyad, called us and reported. They killed injured three nuns, and killed one priest. We know today they shattered the thousands of years old glass stained windows. We know that they exploded the back door to the church. The mayor of the town, who's inside the church right now, Mohammed Medina, called us and verified this. So they did destroy the church.
What's the situation like for food and medicine, especially inside the church and also where you are?
There is no food, no medicine, no water, no electricity. We are probably one of the very few people in the entire Palestinian territory that have electricity. We have a backup system that we have to use sparingly.
So is there any sight of any relief in terms of food or medical aid? Because we did hear that ambulances were being allowed into Manger Square.
Well, I don't know about Manger Square, but I can tell you here, the days are all blurred. I'm sorry, I don't remember exactly, but the Red Crescent did send the ambulance, and I yelled out the window because my husband is out of medication, and the Israeli told me to get back in, and he turned back the ambulance. So they're not allowing anybody to get any kind of aid whatsoever. We know that the Europeans tried to bring in some aid and the Israelis turned them back. We know that Solana tried to come in and the Israelis wouldn't let them. We know there's riots all over the world in support of the Palestinians and saying no to what Sharon and his army are doing. I mean, they are just massacring people. I have watched through my window people being shot. My house was occupied. 50 soldiers just broke into my house, and I told them I was American. They told me they didn't care who I was. I protested as an American. They told me it's no worse than what my country is doing in Palestine. They proceeded to destroy my house, urinated on my floor, and hit me and my husband.
Mahas Bitani, an Arab American, speaking from her home in Ramallah, 100 feet from the compound where Yasser Arafat is being held. Secretary of State Colin Powell is headed to the Middle East in search of a political solution to the latest crisis. Responding to sharp criticism from home and abroad, President Bush today pledged greater American involvement in the conflict. The president said again that Israel had a right to protect itself from terrorist suicide bombers. But for the first time, Bush asked the Israelis to pull out of the Palestinian towns they've occupied in recent weeks. The president also called for an end to the settlement of Palestinian lands. Joshua Chafin reports from Washington.
Secretary Powell will join Special Envoy Anthony Zinni, who has been in Israel ostensibly trying to work out a ceasefire. But Israeli tanks now occupy six Palestinian towns. Today, the president again insisted Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat has the power to call off the suicide bombers. Then he got on board with the rest of the international community in calling for Israeli restraint.
I ask Israel to halt incursions into Palestinian-controlled areas and begin the withdrawal from those cities it has recently occupied. As Israel steps back, responsible Palestinian leaders and Israel's Arab neighbors must step forward and show the world that they are truly on the side of peace.
President Bush says he expects, quote, better leadership in the region.
I expect better leadership. And I expect results. These are the elements of peace in the Middle East. And now we must build the road to those goals.
But reserved all specific criticism for Yasser Arafat. Nonetheless, it was a more balanced speech than Jean Abi Nader expected. He's managing director of the Arab American Institute in Washington.
Despite the fact that it tries to blame the Palestinians for everything, they're responding finally to the initiative from the Arab League. So I think on balance, I find it very helpful.
Reaction from inside the occupied territories is decidedly cooler. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Indigo Gilmore is in Ramallah, the seat of Palestinian government, taken by Israel on Friday. Dozens of Palestinian civilians died in the Israeli invasion. Gilmore says if President Bush really wanted the Israelis to pull back, he could make it happen today.
Well, I think if he'd wanted them to withdraw, or if he really did want the Israelis to stop their operations now, he could do so. I think it would take one phone call. That's certainly the impression I got from speaking to Israeli security officials earlier, that Ariel Sharon had been given a green light by the United States to carry out these operations. And even when General Zinni returned last time to the region as special envoy, the Israelis were still in the middle of a military operation, and it continued for a couple of days after he arrived back. So I think we have to treat some of these claims and statements by President Bush with some caution.
Gilmore says the Palestinians on the ground predict Arafat will be assassinated soon, an opinion shared by the Palestinian Authority itself. In Washington today, Authority Representative Hassan Rahman.
If Mr. Sharon succeeds in his objective of destroying the Palestinian Authority and trying to break the will of the Palestinian people, he is opening the gates of hell wide open in our region. And we are going to go back not to what happened after 67, but what happened after 1948.
Over the congressional recess, Republican House Majority Leader Dick Armey tells the papers it would be fine with him if Arafat were forced into exile. Bills drafted by California Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein, Kentucky Republican Senator Mitch McConnell, and New York House Democrat Gary Ackerman would impose sanctions on Yasser Arafat. They defined the Palestinian Authority as a terrorist organization. There's even talk in Congress of cutting off U.S. non-food aid to the Palestinians. The Arab American Institute's John Abi Nader says Congress is courting Jewish votes at the expense of the peace.
I think Congress sometimes can play a very negative role in what we need to do to move the peace process forward, and this is one of those times when their pandering to the pro-Israeli lobby is worthless and counterproductive. And even the president today had a balanced approach, and that's what Congress should try to do. They should try to represent more a view of what will help as opposed to what makes them feel good vis-a-vis Arafat. None of us are sitting here saying Arafat's the solution to everything or even anything, but at the same time, by denigrating and trying to pass discriminatory resolutions toward one party and doing the finger-pointing without trying to have any balance really hurts our interests in the region.
Congress comes back next week. Joshua Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Moments before President Bush spoke, U.S. officials at the United Nations threatened to veto a Syrian-sponsored motion calling for Israel's immediate withdrawal from Palestinian cities. The motion followed yesterday's day-long debate in the Security Council, in which UN member countries, including major U.S. allies, expressed overwhelming condemnation of Israel's military onslaught. Susan Wood reports from the United Nations.
There can be no military solution to the Middle East conflict. That was the theme of yesterday's debate, in which 58 countries participated. The representative of South Africa, speaking for the Non-Aligned Movement, a grouping of poor and developing nations, expressed concern at Israel's continuing refusal to comply with Security Council resolutions demanding an end to the occupation. The enemy in the Middle East, he said, was not President Arafat or the Palestinian Authority. It was a lack of peace between Israel and Palestine.
We are therefore deeply distressed by the fact that the Israeli government has chosen to respond to the symptoms of its own military occupation by using disproportionate lethal force, with resulting escalation in conflict and tragic consequences for the civilian populations of both Palestine and Israel.
The South African representative went on to say that Israel's militaristic approach was all the more inexcusable, since it was taking place against the backdrop of renewed efforts by the international community to mediate a peaceful solution to the conflict. Fear of the consequences of the escalating violence in the region prompted strikingly similar responses from the European Union and other U.S. allies. For almost the first time since September 11th, the British ambassador took a sharply different tone from his U.S. counterpart.
The deliberate use of violence, and in particular the unproductive and unacceptable escalation in the degree of force used by the Israeli Defense Force, has got to be brought to a halt. The Israeli forces must quickly withdraw from Ramallah and other West Bank towns.
The British ambassador went on to say that Palestinian suicide bombings, which he said are undoubtedly acts of terror, must cease. And he called on the Palestinian Authority to make a 100% effort to that end. But he said the only road to security is a peaceful settlement negotiated by both sides.
President Arafat and the Palestinian Authority are the legitimate representatives of the Palestinian people with whom Israel must be able to resume that dialogue.
Negotiations continued today in hopes of reaching a compromise on the Syrian-backed proposal calling for Israel's immediate withdrawal from Palestinian cities, including Ramallah, where Arafat remains under siege for the seventh day. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
The collapse of Enron brought devastation to thousands of company employees who saw their 401k plans dry up along with the value of Enron's stock. For many in the labor movement, the Enron fiasco serves as a wake-up call to workers whose retirement savings are heavily invested in their company's stock. Yesterday in Milwaukee, the AFL-CIO launched the first of a series of town hall meetings across the United States, calling for Congress to ensure what happened to Enron's workers never happens again. John Hamilton reports.
7 years ago, Deborah Johnson went to work as a senior administrative assistant at Enron's headquarters in Houston. Last November, she was laid off, and a month later, Enron went bankrupt. Not only did she lose $47,000 from her 401k plan, but the company failed to pay her the severance package she had been promised.
When Enron went to bankruptcy, that was the end of it. There was no more servants. Everything was null and void. So I've been living right now off of the unemployment that I am getting, $319 a week, and from my family and friends. I have other coworkers that I'm here speaking for. Their cars have been repossessed. They've been evicted from their homes, from apartments. This is serious.
Johnson is one of more than 6,000 Enron workers who saw their 401k plans collapse with the company. Yesterday, she spoke in Milwaukee in the first of a series of town hall meetings aimed at protecting the pension plans of workers from future corporate bankruptcies. AFL-CIO President John Sweeney was on hand.
Without immediate reforms in 401ks and pension plans, there is a strong possibility that the Enron scandal could repeat itself in other companies.
In many respects, the scandal has repeated itself. Kmart's 24,000 employees have an average of about 14% of their 401k pension money in company stock, shares that plummeted as the company entered bankruptcy in January. And employees at Global Crossing lost huge portions of their retirement savings as the value of their company was reduced to pennies on the dollar.
Enron exposed what many of us have been saying. The boards of directors, auditors, analysts, and regulators that are charged with acting in the interest of investors and the public are riddled with greed, self-dealing, and plain selfishness.
Even as they cashed in millions of dollars of stock options, Kenneth Lay and other Enron executives urged their employees to buy more shares of the company's stock. As Enron collapsed in December, workers were told by managers that they could not cash in their shares.
I think that they ought to be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. They ought to be stripped of any financial gain that they got by illegal means.
For the last 34 years, Derry Ebright has worked for Portland General Electric, an Enron subsidiary. Last winter, he lost $600,000 from his pension fund, much of his life savings. At the time of the company's collapse, 60% of Ebright's 401k was invested in Enron stock.
That's a mistake that a lot of workers right now are making, not just Enron workers, not just Portland General Electric workers. People that have investments in their own company stock, too many of them are just like I was, too heavy in the company that you work for.
For workers who continue to invest in 401ks, the AFL-CIO is pressing Congress for a number of reforms that would increase worker oversight of investment choices. John Sweeney wants to reverse laws that give banks and other creditors priority over workers in bankruptcy lawsuits. The Labor Federation is also backing a bill introduced by Senator Ted Kennedy, which would deter company 401k plans from investing too heavily in company stock. With the Workers' Independent News Service, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm John Hamilton.
Lawyers for Leonard Peltier have filed a lawsuit in Washington, D.C. against former FBI Director Louis Freeh and the FBI Agents Association. In 1977, Peltier was convicted of killing two FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Indian Reserve. The new lawsuit targets action that the FBI agents took in December 2000 when President Clinton was considering granting clemency to Peltier. Joshua Welsh reports from Rapid City, South Dakota, near Pine Ridge.
In June of 1975, FBI agents Jack Coller and Ronald Williams died in a shootout on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. American Indian Movement activist Leonard Peltier was convicted of the murders and sentenced to two consecutive life sentences. But the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee argues that the evidence against him was flawed and that there were no witnesses to the killings. In December of 2000, President Clinton was considering a clemency request for Peltier. Peltier's attorney, Bernard Kleinman, says that's when hundreds of FBI agents protested against Peltier outside the White House. Kleinman says those actions are more than a mere conflict of interest.
These are active agents of the FBI who are normally forbidden from engaging in such activity, notwithstanding the claims that these were all actions were all done while they were on their own free time, where they were quote-unquote off-duty.
Kleinman also says former FBI Director Louis Freeh acted inappropriately when he sent the media copies of letters he wrote to Clinton and former Attorney General Janet Reno. Those letters also objected to clemency for Peltier. Kleinman says to his knowledge, the FBI has never taken actions like these before.
I mean, I think it would be very hard for me to imagine having Chinese FBI agents having demonstrated in favor of Wen-Ho Lee when that whole fiasco occurred a couple of years ago. And I could never imagine that happening, number one. And number two, those agents wouldn't be permitted to do that.
Kleinman says it's especially inappropriate for active FBI agents to comment so publicly on an ongoing case like Peltier's. He says the FBI still refuses to turn over thousands of documents related to the case. Many of the documents which have been released show a pattern of FBI abuses against Peltier and the American Indian movement. Bruce Ellison, another of Peltier's attorneys, says those documents show that the FBI considered the American Indian movement one of the most dangerous groups in the country. Speaking 2 years ago at the 25th commemoration of the original shootout, he said the FBI used oppressive and often bloody tactics to try to quell the movement.
FBI documents talk after Wounded Knee about how let's arrest as many people as possible and see if we can defuse the movement. And then about 8-9 months later, there's another document saying this isn't working. This is not defusing the movement. And then statistically, the death rates out here start to rise astronomically.
Ellison says the FBI also used corrupted evidence to convict Peltier. The FBI had no comment for this story, saying Thursday morning that they were unaware that the suit had been filed. Bernard Kleinman says the current suit won't be able to undo the damage done during President Clinton's clemency consideration, but the suit does seek to stop active FBI agents from taking similar action during future parole hearings.
And every time those parole proceedings have come up, there has been a wave of letter writing and activity on the part of active FBI agents. And what we're seeking is Director Mueller to order his FBI agents, his active FBI agents, to no longer engage in that conduct.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Joshua Welsh in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations KPFA in Berkeley and WBAI in New York City, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. This newscast was produced by Aaron Glantz, headlines editor Randy Zimmerman, technical producer Jade Paget-Seekins. We had web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. I'm Deepa Fernandez.
I'm Scott Gurian in New Jersey, and I report for Free Speech Radio News because it's the best hard-hitting alternative news source on the radio. Free Speech Radio News only stays on the air with your financial support. Please make a donation to Free Speech Radio News online at www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org, or call 510-287-5551. That's 510-287-5551. Thank you for your support.